So third thing was this Newtonian limit. So let us have a look at this gravitational redshift again. But let's do it more properly, equipped with the fact that we know that the gravitational field is described by the metric and blah, blah, blah. So the statement of that is that in strong gravitational field, blah, 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 gravitational field, time ticks more slowly. And the way how you find that is that you look at the proper time. So the proper time is now minus t mu nu dx mu over dt dx nu over dt and dt. That's the definition of the proper time, but I just flipped eta mu nu to g mu nu. And the statement is that if I have a wave, and I have one observer here, another observer here, then this guy sees a frequency. So probably now h bar is equal to 1 as well, or h is equal to 1, doesn't matter. And the frequency will be inverse of how long it takes for the pulses to click here. So d tau is basically 1 over nu of the frequency. Here, the same thing. So I measure how long it takes. There'll be some d tau prime. It's 1 over nu prime.
When you say time passes more slowly, what you mean by that is that coordinate time is slower relative to proper time?
No, that the proper time is different.
Proper time is slower relative to coordinate time.
Huh? You have two observers. Each of them associates his own or her own proper time. So this guy is dt prime. That's why it's d tau.
So proper time is slower relative to other observers and lower gravitational field.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, can somebody say that again? What's the consensus?
that the proper time as measured by this observer will be different than the proper time as measured by that observer. Okay, so now, because that they are inverse, so I have nu prime over nu is d tau over d tau prime, no matter what constants are there. So now this is that square root of there as evaluated. Let's say this guy is at point x mu, and this guy case coordinates x mu prime. Okay, so this will be evaluated at x and dt. And this guy will be evaluated at x prime and dt prime. Okay, this is what it is. So now let's make an assumption, simplifying assumption at this point, that none of these guys actually move with respect to their coordinates. They are static. They associate their coordinates in the way that they don't move in these coordinates, right? So observers do not move, which means that, and you are looking here, it will be only the first component of dx mu over dt, which will be non-trivial, and all the other components will be 0. So I'll have only dt over dt. So you will look like 1, 0, 0, 0, okay? Which means that only g 0, 0 will contribute here, okay? So this equals to minus g 0, 0 evaluated at x dt, and the same thing here will be minus g 0, 0 evaluated at x prime and dt prime. Is this clear?
that g zero? Is that the components of g in that frame? So should it be like g prime zero?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm not bothered by this. I'm bothered by dt over dt prime. So now I do another assumption. And that assumption is that I am in stationary spacetimes. Stationary spacetimes. That is, spacetimes which do not vary in time. And if something doesn't vary in time, nothing prevents this observer to choose the same time as that observer here, the same coordinate time. So if you are in stationary spacetimes, so then you can choose a global coordinate time t. So that this observer will be using the same coordinate time as that observer. And you can always do that if you're in stationary spacetimes. Okay, so we have beautiful formula. So from here, the formula is the nu prime over nu equals to minus g 0, 0 at x and minus g 0, 0 x prime. And that's the gravitational redshift. So, and this is much more general than what we have done before. So let's have a look at that as a trivial application in the Newtonian case. You recover what we had by this Einstein elevator argument. So let's look at that. So in Newtonian limit, I have nu prime over nu equals 2. So now, what is g 0, 0 in Newtonian limit? It's still over there hiding in the middle blackboard, right? It's minus 1 plus 2 phi over c square, right? So this is 1 plus 2 phi, and the other one is 1 plus 2 phi prime. And c square is 1. At this point. Okay, I'll be setting c square equal to 1 and then returning it back and so on. So anyway, so phi, if you are in Newtonian, phi is much smaller. If you are on the surface of the Earth, it's 10 to minus 9. Phi is 10 to minus 9, right? So this is very, very small, so I can expand that. So this will be 1 plus phi, and this guy will be 1 minus phi prime. I'm expanding the square root of that. So this is 1 plus phi minus phi prime, and then something which is much smaller than that. So now, as before, you define redshift, which is z, which is delta of the frequency with respect to the original frequency. So this is nu prime minus nu over nu, which is this guy minus 1. So it's phi minus phi prime. So now we can plug for your phi any Newtonian potential you want, right? So we can do the proper Newton's law. But for us, is this? Let's recover the result which we had before. So let's do homogeneous gravitational field. So specifically, choose homogeneous gravitational field. And then phi is g times h, right? Where h is the height where I am. So it'll be h1 minus h2. So that is, so now just think about the sign. Statement is sign is minus, well, depending what delta h is, right? And then I return back c square. This is over phi over c square is the dimensionless quantity. And this is what we derived by our Einstein elevator argument. Okay, so that formula is, so we made lots of assumptions that our observers do not move, our space-time is stationary, but still this formula is very nice in general. It's a general relativistic formula. But once you do a Newtonian limit, you find that z is phi minus phi prime. This is still much more general formula than we discovered yesterday, because you can do any Newtonian potential here. But now specifying the homogeneous field, we recovered the result which we had before. Okay. So the final thing.
David?
Yeah?
So somehow here you're implying that nu prime is greater than nu or vice versa, right?
Yeah.
So I can always find a coordinate transformation where I will see like a higher frequency than in another coordinate frame. I mean, the shift could be
Well, here I'm static, so I'm not really changing frames, right? So I'm static with respect to my gravitational field, right? And yeah. So it depends where in the gravitational field I am, whether I'm here or whether I'm there. That's what matters. Yeah. Well, think about it. So okay, so now the big picture. So field theory of gravity. So we want to construct this, right? But we already have many things. So first of all, what is field theory, right? So the simplest thing is for Maxwell. So in the electromagnetic case. So what is the theory consisting of, right? So first of all, you need to identify a field, right? So you need field. So what is field in Maxwell theory? It's either f mu nu or a mu, right? So it's these things. So let me put a mu. Let me put a mu. Doesn't matter. Okay, so that's field. I identified my field. Now, the next thing I need is that if I know the field, what is the motion of charges, for example? How is that determined? That's called equation of motion. Motion. And that will be that dp mu over d tau equals to q times f mu nu u nu, which is the Lorentz force. Right? So provided I know the field already, I want to know how my charge is or how what's happening in that field, right? To particles, charged particles, blah blah blah. That's equation of motion. And finally, I need a field equation. Field equation, which tells me, well, if I have some sources of the like currents and charges and so on, what field they produce, right? And that's Maxwell equation. So I have d mu f mu nu just the minus my mu zero j mu and d mu f mu kappa cyclic is the three terms equals to zero. So any field theory which is meaningful consists of three things. You have to identify your field. You have to provide an equation of motion, provided that you know already the field, how the particles move. And you also need to provide, when you know how the particles move, what are the sources, how to find the fields. These are three elements of any field theory which you need to find. So now, how does this look in Newton? That's simple. So in Newton, what is the field? Phi is this Newtonian potential phi. What is the equation of motion? You already used it, right? So it's that dp over dt equals to minus gradient of phi. That's the equation of motion. And finally, what is the field equation in Newtonian theory? Yeah, that's right. It's better. So, Have you ever seen this? Okay, so you know this again from electrostatics. You know that if I have charge density, I produce electrostatic charge here, electrostatic potential here. But now it's exactly the same thing in Newton's gravity. Okay, so that's the field equation for Newton. So finally, for Einstein, you also need these three elements. So I was trying to convince you that the field now is the g mu nu, is the metric which you are looking for. So now what is the equation of motion? Exactly. So we already know that. So it's d u mu over d tau plus gamma mu alpha beta u alpha u beta equals to 0. Okay. So you already know 2/3 of the theory, right? So what remains is the last piece. And the last piece is the Einstein equation for the field. G mu nu equals to 8 pi T mu nu, which we will now proceed to, and we will spend 1 week actually deriving this. Okay, but you know already 2/3 of that. So now, if you want to compare this guy with that guy, you see, well, phi is g mu nu, so phi plays the role of g mu nu. Actually, it's contained in g 0, 0. So now you have two derivatives acting on phi here. So this g mu nu will be function of second derivatives of g, right? And then t mu nu is the stress energy tensor, which corresponds to, you know, energy momentum density. So there will be something like this row here. Okay, so that's where we are heading now. Questions? Yeah?
So what is the field equation? I mean, the source of field for like the scalar field.
Sorry, what is the source here?
Oh, no. I mean, the source for say scalar field and Dirac field. Is there any field equation
for what's good thing. Okay. Maybe let me answer that later after this. So I think I want to do one more thing in 5 minutes. And so let me start the third section. And I know that you are dying to know what the manifold is. So I'll give you the definition of the manifold. So this finishes the section two, where we had first look at GR. And we almost understood GR, but there's still a little bit missing here. So in order to appreciate that third thing over there, the Einstein equations, we have to start the geometry. So third section is mathematical tools of GR. And first part will be manifolds. So let me draw a manifold. Okay. This is the manifold. And it may have some holes in it. There's another hole here. Okay. And the statement is that manifold is an object which locally looks like basically R to the N, like a flat space. Or Minkowski space if you are in signature minus plus plus plus. So it has locally the differential structure of R to the N, but not necessarily its global properties. So n-dimensional manifold, dimensional manifold has local differential structure of R to the N in Riemannian case or Minkowski space in the pseudo-Riemannian case, but not necessarily global properties. So what does it mean is that if I choose a point in my manifold here, then locally here, it almost looks like R to the n. It's another point here, it looks like R to the n. It's another point here, which looks like R to the n. But the whole thing doesn't look like R to the n, right? Because there are holes, there are other things. Okay, so let me give you the definition, the formal definition, which is ugly and difficult and blah, blah, blah. But it's not, okay, so definition of the manifold, a manifold is a set of points together with a collection, the collection of subsets O alpha, such that, and there are three properties of the manifold. So first is that each point in that manifold lies in at least one of these subsets, in at least one O alpha, which means, what it means is that it has our subsets, they cover the whole manifold. Flying gravity in practice. Okay. Okay. So second, for each alpha, there is one to one. Onto, right? Map, which is called psi alpha, which goes from that subset of the manifold, so it goes from the region in the manifold, to some subregion of R to the n, to U alpha, where this is a subset, open subset of R to the n. Okay, so there is a, so each O alpha is basically like I can map it to some region in the R to the n. Okay, and third, if any two sets, that's O alpha and O beta overlap, that is O alpha and O beta is non-trivial, then the map I will draw a picture, psi beta, psi alpha minus 1 is differentiable, infinitely times differentiable. So this is the definition of the manifold. Okay, let me draw a picture. It's going up. So let's say this is my manifold M, and then I have two regions, O alpha here, and a region O beta here. Okay. Then from this region, there is a map, psi beta, which goes to the R to the N. And this region O beta is mapped to some open subset here, so U beta. Okay. So now the same thing for this guy. There is a map to the R to the N, and this region is mapped to the U alpha here, an open subset of this R to the N. So this is psi alpha, right? But now there's an overlap of the regions. Right? There's this guy here, which is overlapping, which has the same, which is for O beta and O alpha. So let's say that this part is here, and that part is here. So then the statement is that you need, for the manifold to be true, that everything is nice and smooth. Everything patches smoothly nicely together. You can be sewn together very smoothly. So what is the map from here to there? It's a map from R to the N to the R to the N. So it's just a function which goes from R to the N to R to the N. And you know how to do, you know, calculus of multidimensional calculus. It's just a thing. So now this thing here is, first, I have to go from here to there and from there to here. So this is a map which is psi beta, psi alpha to minus 1. So psi minus 1 goes from here to the manifold, and then psi beta goes over there. So this is the map which goes from here to there. Okay? And it's just a function which goes from R to the N to the R to the N. And this must be C infinity function, so infinitely times differentiable function, so that you have some smoothness in your thing. Okay. So that's the picture. That's what means that part 3. And then all the others are basically intuitive, right? So this is a formal definition. This is what the non-trivial part of the definition means. So let me stop here, and let me continue tomorrow from here. Questions?